So in this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Anne-Marie Brouwer, who's a senior scientist at TNO in Soesterberg in the Netherlands, where she works as part of the Perceptual Cognitive Systems Group. Now, Anne-Marie is a scientist working for industry rather than a university, so that was one reason I was interested to speak with her. She has a background in cognitive experimental psychology, but she's done lots of other things since, some of which we'll be talking about in the podcast. What I like about Anne-Marie's work is that she's very much an applied researcher, but with a very keen eye on methodology and methodological rigour, which is just as important, if not more important, for people doing applied work than it is for traditional laboratory-based research. So during our conversation, we talk about a lot of different things. We talk about her background, as well as specific pieces of work on brain-computer interfaces, how you measure stress, looking at synchrony between two people when they're working together, and some of her more recent work on the perception of taste and food. So we spoke in a hotel bar in Toulouse at the end of 2019. So I'm afraid there's a lot of background ambience on this recording. So as well as myself and Anne-Marie, this podcast also features some other guests, such as the four ladies at the next table, who joined us halfway through, and a very squeaky door that makes an occasional appearance. So I hope you can hear our conversation okay, and that the background noise isn't too annoying. Let me tell you the first thing. The first time I remember being at a conference where you were speaking. Now, these conferences we used to go to, there would be lots of people from lots of different backgrounds. And when you spoke, I thought, this lady is an experimental cognitive psychologist. is that what your background is?
And that's exactly true, yeah. I think that was in Delmenhorst, or no, that was in this...
I think it was before that. I think it may have been in Amsterdam or somewhere like that, at the Effective BCI or something like that.
Yeah, I am.
So that was your degree was psychology originally?
Yeah, experimental psychology or cognitive psychology,
and
yes.
Whereabouts?
I did my studies in Nijmegen, in the Netherlands.
Okay.
Functieleer, it's called the study, the direction that I did in Dutch. It's called Functieleer.
Okay. Well, the Dutch academic system has a really strong tradition of experimental psychology through it. So it's kind of quite, when I see it, it's quite obvious to me where you're coming from. And I've been looking back through your stuff because the stuff I know you best for is BCI. Research, but you've actually done lots of other different things as well. There's strands that run through your work, and one of the early ones is perceptual multitasks.
Yes.
I noticed.
Yeah.
And so was that what you did for your PhD work was on perceptual motor skills?
Yeah, that's right.
And what was it about specifically?
It was on finding out what visual information people use to intercept moving objects.
Right.
So you can think of catching a ball.
Yeah.
And in our case, actually, that was with Ellie Brenner and Jeroen Smeets, and there was another group of PhD students, and we were all working on hitting running spiders.
Really?
So simulated spiders. Oh. And then, yeah, not real, and it would have taken ages to train them. No, we had virtual spiders running across a plastic kind of thing, and people had to hit them with a stick.
Okay.
And we were recording the hand movements, and then you can do a lot of things, because if you think of it, that is even possible to do this task.
Yes.
It's really short, and you get your hands at the right time in the at the right position.
Yes.
How can you know where to be and what kind of visual information do you use, and how do you process that? And by looking at these hand trajectories and the velocities and so on, we were kind of trying to find this out. And can you, for instance, have the spider jump and then still take this into account in this very fast hand movement that was thought to be ballistic, like if you start it you cannot change it, but actually you can still do things on the fly. So
based on my kind of naive reading of this area, when you do something like that, you have a stage where you decide which hand you're going to use to do it, which hand you're going to recruit, and then there is a process of parameterization or selecting the parameters of the movement. People experience it as unconscious, but is it really? Is it really an unconscious sort of thing?
I mean, it's very fast. Like, these movements are about like 250 milliseconds or so, the ones that we looked at.
But if people play tennis or something like that, they obviously get better at doing those sorts of things. Because with tennis, you're hitting a moving object with your hand.
I think you have to automate things. So maybe if you learn to do these kind of things, you first have another kind of thinking strategy that you have to internalize more or less.
And what you said, you were looking at hand positions. So were you just filming them, or?
So we had an OptoTrack. It's device that follows like IRED. So we had infrared emitting diodes on the stick that was used to hit.
Okay.
And that was recorded. So then you can look at these trajectories over time. So, and we also looked in at eye movements and this kind of.
So it's kind of like motion capture.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah,
way?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And that was really, really fun to me. Like, you have this data, this position over time, and how can you extract variables from that? And so that was really nice.
Because I noticed some papers that you had that were on perceptual psychophysics, basically. One was about hitting a moving target, hand velocity when you hit a moving target. And you did another one about grasping behavior?
Yes, yeah.
As
also,
well?
My postdoc work was also on eye-hand coordination or on grasping. Indeed, that you can look at how far are the thumb and the index finger apart, because that says something about how big the object is that you're going to grasp, and is that influenced by size illusions or not, and this kind of those kind of topics.
It sounds really interesting. Is it still an active area for you?
No, not anymore. Although I just told previously when I was talking to Fabian, I am maybe moving a little bit back to this motor behavior again in the context of robotics and haptic feedback.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But for the last, 12 years or so, I've been really working on more the BCI or mental state monitoring kind of stuff.
Because it strikes me that with virtual reality systems, that this work is very pertinent now.
Yeah,
In terms of how you design those sorts of things as well.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I wanted to say and to make clear to people who are listening to it is that you don't work at a university as such, do you?
Mm-hmm.
So you work at TNO. Mm-hmm. So can you just tell people what TNO is to people who've never heard of it?
Yes, it's an applied research institute.
Yeah.
It's similar to Fraunhofer in Germany.
Yeah.
And it's there are a little over 3,000 people working there in a really lot of different applied research areas.
Okay.
Really varying. And that is also very nice that you have all these different topics in one institute. And I'm in Soesterberg, which is focusing on human factors research.
Okay.
And we do research for governments and for also like European projects and so on, and also for companies. So it's,
So is it a government run organization?
Yeah, it's founded by law. It is an independent research organization.
Okay.
But I think about a third of the funding is from government.
And then the rest is your.
Yeah.
You have to go out for yourself and do this. Okay. And so there's several of these places around the Netherlands.
Yeah.
And your one specializes in human factors.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm interested in is how, as an academic, you go to a department and you do your research. But in your case, I mean, do you do that or you're basically directed to certain areas? Does it work more like it does in industry, I think?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, I think.
Yeah.
So A lot of the researchers are getting their own projects, more or less,
yes.
Through their contacts and so on. But also, sometimes a project comes in and they really ask you, do you want to work on this? Or, yeah, it's really
yeah.
a bit like that.
So I guess the advantage of that is that there's always new things
yes.
happening and
yeah.
that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
The disadvantage is that you perhaps don't get to develop continuity
yeah.
with the work.
That's both very true.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
But you obviously, it works for you.
Yeah, it works. Yeah, so it's especially, so when I started at TNO, there was this big BCI project, the Brain Computer Interfaces project that just started.
Yeah.
And basically that's why I kind of started this research, because I was new and that started and okay, let's do that.
Yeah.
And I was thinking in the beginning like, oh, what is this? Is something completely different from
yeah.
what I have been doing up till now. So I have no clue whether this is a good idea, but let's see about it. And then it's just really nice. It's really it's good for me that I'm forced sometimes to do some new topic, and then you really have this learning curve.
Yeah.
That you really every paper that you read is new or interesting.
Yeah.
And that is really fun. And also what you mentioned. So I'm an experimental psychologist.
Yeah.
And many people in the BCI field up to then are engineers or
yes.
Mathematicians or. That is very needed, so it's very interdisciplinary, but also as a cognitive psychologist who knows how to set up experiments, you obviously can contribute something, even if you just start in this area. So that works really well for me, also this working with these other people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that, yeah.
Because I guess being an experimental psychologist is fundamentally about understanding methodology.
Yeah.
And that is a general purpose
yes.
skill.
Yes, yeah.
There are lots of different things.
Yeah.
Would you say you're happiest doing applied work? Is that, you enjoy that more than, you know, say doing purely theoretical work?
Yeah, I think at least the most of the work that I've been doing is, in a sense, maybe not that applied still.
Yeah.
And it's still also about experiments in the lab and experiments also outside of the lab, but it's, but I like it most that you really get in touch also with different application areas. So even if it's not an application yet,
yeah.
So that is also what you mentioned, what is a disadvantage, or you cannot sometimes pursue your line that you think this is the most promising to work on, but there's just no projects for it, so then you do something else again.
Yeah.
But that also really brought me into contact with really different potential application fields and people who know about the content of a certain area, like food industry, virtual reality, streaming of video images, or defense, or user interfaces that I didn't know. So that is really nice.
Yeah, I can see that. And you've already answered one of my questions I had. I was going to ask you, how did you become interested in BCI? But from what you just told me, you started work and it was
completely random.
Yeah.
More or less.
You're still active in BCI.
Yeah,
obviously you like working in BCI.
Yeah, also because I felt there were things really to do. It was also, and I also really like that about this field. That it was quite young and still and developing.
Yeah.
So I really remember the first conference and I was really excited because it was quite open with new people and everybody was interacting
yes.
a lot. And that was really nice.
So what was your introduction to brain-computer interfaces? And I'm kind of saying this for people who might not know what they are, because when you have a brain-computer interface, you generally have two forms. One is for active control, so this is where we use the signals from the brain to substitute for a mouse or a keyboard. And there is, I guess, passive BCI, which is where we are measuring different states of a person that occur spontaneously, like emotions and thoughts, and then the computer responds to those. So did you go in active or the other way? Or which?
Reactive.
Reactive. We do have reactive as well. Yeah.
I would say that's more active.
Kind of.
So that was, then when I started, that was 11, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And we were working on the tactile P300.
Yes.
So P300, that is a peak that occurs whenever a stimulus is presented that you are attending to. And it was usually done using visual or auditory stimuli.
Yeah.
And we looked at tactile, little vibrators that were like around the waist of somebody.
Yeah.
And the idea was that this would give kind of, if you kind of vibrate them sequentially around the waist and you attend to one of them, and you, for instance, you want to go have your wheelchair turn right, you attend to the vibrating on the right, and the computer can recognize this and do this. It turned out that also ALS patients who was the most important envisioned user group of BCI, they also get problems with vision and so on. So maybe the tactile domain would be interesting for them.
So people with ALS are people who cannot move any part of their body at all. Is that correct?
Okay. But I have to say, so also at TNO, or we did not work with these patients, or also TNO in general is more like looking at broader user groups. So also the idea was that maybe healthy users could use these kinds of devices as an extra hand kind of thing. So we started out on this topic, and it was really we got nice results with the tactile P300 BCI, and that was all good. We had Marieke Teurlings, a PhD student, did her PhD on this. I was a bit like not so happy
really?
With it, in the sense that I could not really envision how this would be useful soon for healthy people. Because of course, if you can still move things, if you have other ways to communicate with the outside world, then it's more practical, less errors, faster to use those means. Just say something or even blink maybe or twitch a muscle or something. So that was a bit I was at that stage. And then I went also to this first conference, and there was a talk so we're actually the tactile P300, we won the poster prize, so that is also a good start. But there was a talk by Thorsten Zander on the passive BCI, and then that is like that you just use EEG and as an extra signal, like you do whatever you do, but you use the BCI technology to estimate somebody's cognitive or emotional states, and use that. And I said, I like this better. This is at least you can have maybe broader user groups in this sense. So then I also met you also and with effective computing, and like you can get to this idea. There were already other research fields working on this, but I really came from this active BCI direction to it. And so that then really became more the research direction that I am.
Going back to the tactile P300 system. So you're wearing sensors on your body, which give you, is it vibrotactile stimulation?
Yeah, it's really the same kind of tactile that is in a mobile phone.
Yeah, so it's a little buzz.
Motor.
And then you get an array of stimuli.
Yeah.
Say, going north, east, south, whatever. Yeah. And then the one that you give the biggest, the one that receives the biggest P300 response is taken as the target state.
Yeah.
So that kind of sounds like a reactive BCI, because you're probing the person with stimuli and then going, which one do you want to go with?
Yeah. So that's in that sense reactive. But I would say, I don't really care about those names, but the thing, I would also see it as more similar to active, because it does require your active attention more or less. So that is also a study. Yeah, so we were also a bit worried about that, like in real applications.
Yeah.
If you are also doing other things. So I mean, most of this research is done in the lab where there's nothing else except for these stimuli.
Yeah.
But if you are doing other, like you are processing other information and you're doing another task, does it still work? And we did also with Marieke Turling's experiments on that. I don't even remember exactly what other task we introduced. But
you put two tasks together.
Yes,
yeah.
And then it really influenced. It really
the accuracy rate fell.
Yeah. So that's and that makes sense. Like you cannot devote your whole attention to this.
But if you contrast with what we started off talking about, where you started talking about hand movements that were so fast you didn't need to think about them. And then here we are talking about a different way of creating movement for someone who's in a wheelchair, where they have to concentrate all the time. Then that's going to be exhausting for them to do.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, and then maybe we just don't have the proper brain signal yet.
Yeah.
Because the P300 is more maybe conscious attention, and it is really a signal. We use it for everything because it is really a nice signal that really is relatively clear. And also I think the whole this attention, paying attention, is a concept that is important for also a lot of passive applications. P300 is good.
The P300 is good because, as I explained to people, it's a positive deflection of a EEG signal, a brain signal, called an evoked cortical response as well.
And it's
large, isn't
it? It's large. And what is very good also is that it's quite similar across people.
Yes.
So you can generalize better.
Also see, I mean, the original idea is that we could do this in order to let people who cannot control their movement, give them control over their movement. And then there was this other thing, and you're reminding me of discussions back in 12 years ago or so, where people were saying, well, healthy users will want to use active BCIs. And I was always saying, why? For the reasons that you said. So you don't buy into the idea of, well, it's kind of like extra bandwidth, is that they could...
Yeah, for active BCI, I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, maybe very specific applications or when there are other developments. But right now, it's a bit hard to imagine.
So, the nice thing about the passive BCI idea... and the things that I was talking about, physiological computing stuff, is the same idea, really, is that it's you're basically tapping into a signal that's already there.
Yeah.
And the person doesn't have to do anything additional or
just
pay attention.
Free extra information.
Yeah, yeah.
I know.
But because it's free, it's free.
Except for wearing all these sensors.
Yeah, you're wearing the sensors and so on. But because it's spontaneous, then it can be quite difficult to interpret, because as we know, if you're measuring signals from the brain or from the body, they can respond to anything in the room at any time,
or in your own mind.
Yeah, it's internally generated stuff as well. So, did you start to do work on the passive BCI stuff after that point?
So I would say, passive BCI. So often BCI also refers to closed loop thing.
Well, I prefer so, closed loop now, yeah, to be honest. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think all the work after that is in that direction.
Yeah.
And then indeed you have to, this interpretation is can be challenging. So you have to think of ways how to do that.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we did is using combining the EEG with eye movements, and so if you have people look around, and you take the fixation as a starting point to lock the EEG tool, you can also do the same like P300 thing. Is somebody looking now at something that is interesting or not, or that he or she pays attention to or not? So we worked on that, so then you have some kind of connection with the real with the world.
No, but this is important, I think, because what you're saying is I can record brain signals and they're very sensitive, but it's also hard to interpret them. So by taking another measure, this case eye movement, I have the context for that for that brain movement. So it is kind of like it's kind of like an experiment in a way, because you're trying to define the variable by understanding the context within which the data is collected.
Yeah.
And did that work out?
Yeah, at least in the lab. Because also that is always kind of the struggle or the kind of thing. You want to be sure that it's really brain signals you're looking at and not artifacts of eye, like, eye movements, artifacts that can be confounded. So we did a few experiments actually on this topic, and they are quite controlled, but it works for that.
Okay.
And actually, currently we are also doing a fixation locked. We call it all the fixation locked everything experiment. So also looking at electrodermal activity, so that's sweating and pupil size and heart rate, all also locking that to
the fixation.
To fixation. Yeah. So currently, but yeah. And another thing about this context. So that was what I talked about this morning.
Yeah.
Is the synchrony. Stuff.
Yeah.
So that is also a kind of solution to deal with not knowing the context.
Now I should say something about the background, because that's an interesting thing, because we've been talking so far about recording signals from the brain and the body from an individual who's doing something. And now when you say synchrony, what you're talking about is recording a signal from two people or from
more.
Recording signals from multiple people who are doing the same thing at the same time?
Yeah, or are hearing or seeing the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they don't need to be exactly in a group, but they have to be in a group and more or less hear or see the same thing, or separately hearing or seeing the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the basic idea of that, so it was also done by other people using EEG. So is that whenever the signals of multiple people change in the same way, something is going on that draws everybody's attention.
Yes.
And that's kind of and that in itself can be interesting. So you can relate it to the context, like what happened then at that moment. But even if you don't know about the context, it could be nice to monitor, like, a general drop in attention, for instance, over time.
Yeah.
So that is still experiments that we want to do.
Yeah.
And we looked in the experiments that we recently did. We also recorded not only EEG, but also heart rate and skin conductors, to also look at these kind of simultaneous changes in those other measures.
Yeah.
And that's worked. I'm quite enthusiastic about it, how well it works.
I think it is. I think it's a very good, a very good approach. And kind of what you did, as I remember, is that you had people listen to an audiobook.
Yeah.
And you recorded brain signals, EEG, and recorded heart rate, and recorded skin conductance as well. And while you were doing that, you also interrupted them with sounds as well, some of which were emotionally neutral and some of which were emotionally resting, like you had the sound of a baby crying, I remember.
Yeah.
And so you find you get more of a universal response.
Yeah, actually, that I didn't even mention it in the talk. So we had this audio book, and we had different types of audio stimuli played through it for everybody. And those were beeps or emotional sounds. And so part of the participants had to listen, were instructed to attend to the audio book, and the other part of the participants had to attend to these other stimuli.
Yeah.
And we actually thought that maybe the emotional stimuli, because they're emotional, they would draw everybody's attention, maybe. But yeah, and we still can look more into depth because some of the stimuli were more emotional than others.
Yeah.
So I would expect that we can still see a difference between those types of stimuli, but still already now also for the emotional ones we could we still saw a difference between the two attentional groups.
Yeah.
So people who were instructed to attend to the narrative were apparently not completely drawn by those emotional
because they were paying attention.
Yeah, and as I said, so there was also a lawnmower or something that's not very emotional.
So I think the thing is with the synchrony stuff is that a lot of the time when we do these experiments, we're trying to, in a way, overcome individual differences so we get kind of clean data. So here what you're doing is you're kind of looking at points of correspondence between multiple people in order to see this synchrony occurring.
Yeah, and it's also getting the signal out of the noise in this kind of way.
And I know we've been talking about this a lot today, but this physiological synchrony, and I'm talking about synchrony between brains when they do the same thing, or synchrony between bodies. What do you think is going on there? Do you think it is a real psychological phenomenon? Do you think it is just a case of because they do the same thing, then the brain behaves the same way, and there is not it is not really to do with correspondence between the experience?
But that would be kind of correspondence of the experience.
I guess so.
It depends a little, because they're if you move your arms, then this example, if we both move our arms, both of our heart rates go up.
Yes.
And that is not really, we can still have a different experience.
Yes, of course.
In that sense. But I think, so for heart rate, so it depends a bit on the signal. Maybe.
I know, but something that I've seen, I know this is a newspaper report, right? But they said people singing in choirs. It is good for people to sing in choirs because a study has shown that the heart rates synchronize.
Oh, no. That's too vague for me.
But you can see what is happening, can't you?
People are
doing something together that is communal, that is enjoyable.
Yeah.
But they're breathing in the same way.
Yeah, but so I do, I mean, of course, it's very nice if people do things
of course,
together.
Of course.
But I don't really think, so I think then you will observe synchrony.
Yeah.
But I am looking, and that is also one of the things that we want to do, also with Ivo Stoeldreer,
PhD
student. We really want to go into this topic and also maybe try to get like all these papers synchronized now. because maybe a lot can be explained or with this joint attention thing, I think. And then joint attention, and then you can think of, are we really measuring attention? Or it's kind of sometimes mixed, like we both attend to the beeps and process them, so it's also joint workloads, kind of. So, but I think that is at the basis of a lot of the work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So joint hypothesis, the joint attention hypothesis is simply that people are paying attention.
Yeah.
In the same way at the same time.
Yes,
to
and doing more or less the same mental processes. Yeah.
I can see it being really interesting. I can also, it's interesting from a point of view of social neuroscience and things like that.
Yeah.
I can also see people like advertising industry being very interested in it.
Yeah.
For different reasons, maybe. So, okay. So, let us leave synchrony behind for a moment. And I wanted to ask you something, because I'm doing quite a bit of work in VR at the moment. So I noticed a thing on your CV, but VR streaming?
Yes. Yeah.
So
yeah,
could you tell me what that is?
I like that project a lot also, because that is kind of, that project also was tapping, or kind of, how do you say it? There are some challenges in BCI research, and this one was a good application that could kind of deal with it. Well, it is about, and that it was also coming really from a TNO colleague who is working on this data streaming. So they are really all about bandwidth, or how can we send all this data on, also on cheap consumer electronics.
Yes, okay.
So if you want to be, for instance, in a soccer stadium and watch, or you want to be virtually in a soccer stadium to watch a live game.
Yeah.
That is kind of the case. Then you have this 360 degrees of images that you have to send to this virtual reality the headset of the user.
So you talk about doing it live in real time.
Yes.
Live event.
And then there are kind of issues with bandwidth.
Yeah,
and
of course.
And so this guy actually asked, like, can you with brain signals predict whether a head is going to rotate?
Because as in left to right rotation.
Because then if you know that, then you can, if you know the head is going to be still, then you can only, you only need to send the images, the video of your field of view. And if it's likely that the head is going to turn right, then you can decide to spend bandwidth to already load the video images of the stuff on the right. So it can help you to decide what to spend your bandwidth on. So that is the idea, and that is for me really, I thought that is really a good case because you have a ground truth. So you can actually record somebody's head movements. You can collect data like, you can collect brain data and head rotation data and build a model on the fly, maybe like that is getting increasingly better at predicting rotation, and maybe change and improve a system, and you don't need to be 100% correct, and all this kind of thing, and collecting training data to train a model would be.
But what do you need the brain data for if you just need to know what position the head is in?
So it is to, if you can predict that the head is going to rotate. So, and of course, you're in your brain, there's already something happening before you actually rotate your head.
So it's a predictive model of head movement.
Yeah, and there was already work on this in the predicting foot, leg or arm movements.
Yeah.
Also with the idea, like, if you have an emergency brake in a car, can you be even faster if you can predict, can see this coming? And they showed it is possible in a single trial, and even better also than using EMG, for instance.
Than using EMG. So use an ERP, a single trial ERP?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So that was like based on motor readiness potential. So and it was not done about for head rotation, but so we did an experiment to try and predict head rotation, and
No, that sounds really cool. I like the idea as well of the predictive side of it. And obviously, in this case, it's to enhance a technological delivery system.
Yeah.
But the same approach can be applied in other places.
Yeah.
You know, for,
know,
where response times are crucial.
Yes. Yeah. And predicting movement indeed is has in contrast to mental state monitoring. So yeah. Is it a mental state? I don't know. It's not really a cognitive or emotional state, but it is something that you can label data more reliably.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's really true. An attractive thing. Yeah.
Now, one thing that I've started to look at recently, and I see you've done some work on this, is that I think we're both interested sometimes in creating emotional experiences for people in a controlled way in a laboratory. And as you know, and well, people might not know, but psychologists have an array of different techniques for inducing stress in people and, you know, giving people mental arithmetic and so on. But I saw you done a VR study on measuring stress in VR.
Oh, yeah.
Using EEG, and you measure cortisol as well. Yeah. Cortisol is a hormone associated with stress. Yeah. So what did people do in VR that was stressful for them?
They were like in a kind of environment in a militarily-like environment, and they had to look out for bombs or so. And at some point also a bomb exploded, and it was with we used the tactile vest for that.
Oh,
so
did
really
you?
A good shock.
Yeah.
We try to do to induce stress in people.
Yeah.
But actually, it is really hard to do this. Also, with this experiment, I don't know how stressed people really were.
Yeah.
So that really led actually to the sing a song stress paradigm. I don't know.
But before we talk about that, did the cortisol change in the VR?
But there were some issues.
Okay. It's salivary cortisol?
Yeah, there was some effect, but it was not very clear.
It's tough to create genuine stress, even with realistic simulation, because there's no consequences.
Yeah.
Because it's a computer game.
People know that they're...
Really, yeah.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the next thing I wanted to talk about that you already mentioned, because you've got a paradigm here called the sing-a-song paradigm for stress. Yeah. So is this a karaoke paradigm?
It is a paradigm. So that's really also my cognitive psychology background, maybe. Really well-controlled paradigm. Because we know from psychology, like the Trier social stress test.
Yes.
That is really one of the paradigms that induces the biggest responses.
And I should say, so people know, that the Trier social stress test is where you have to make a presentation where an audience evaluate how well you are doing.
Yeah. So. And this audience is kind of looking not very
impressed.
Responsive.
Indeed.
And you have to count backwards, and they say, oh, you have to do it again, and they have really some instructions also to make you quite nervous. And that works very well, but for physiological experiments it's not maybe so suitable, because if people stand up and talk and so on to this audience, then what is the baseline? There's body movement, talking, and also you need this whole audience that is instructed, so it's also not very easy to do it. So actually this sing-a-song stress paradigm is quite based on that, but it's we try to make it more controlled and short.
Yeah.
So it is... people just sit behind a computer screen, and there is a sentence displayed, like some boring sentence where we took sentences about vacuum cleaners from Wikipedia. Like, this cannot excite anybody.
You don't know.
You never
know.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you see the sentence, and then there is a counter counting down. Yeah, in the original paradigm, it was from 60 seconds to zero, and then another sentence appears, and another counter. And then after a few sentences, the sentence comes up, when the counter is at zero again, you have to sing a song aloud. And also in the room, there are two people behind you sitting there who are supposedly other participants.
Yeah.
So there is some kind of audience that, yeah. that is. So you are really embarrassed in this quiet lab environment to sing a song. So it's really genuine stress. It is really a stressful
Yeah, situation. They can sing whatever song they want.
Yeah, yeah. And then you can compare the countdown intervals, because everything,
yeah,
it's exactly the same. They sit still, they see this counter counting down, but only in the last interval,
yeah.
they're really like, oh,
yeah, yeah.
stressed. And it really works well, so I was very happy. So we use it for quite in different experiments, because you see the skin conductance goes up and heart rate, pupil size, and it's really, you can often see it.
How long's the counter take?
Yeah, so in this original version, 60 seconds, but now we have it 30 seconds.
60 seconds, a long time to
worry
about singing.
Yeah,
song.
But you can we now made it shorter,
yeah.
because that's, yeah, you don't really need 60 seconds. Yeah.
No, it sounds nice.
So it's quite, you can do it, it's quite a short test. And we also used it, for instance, in a test in which we wanted to look at stress or at emotions affect when tasting food.
Of course.
So we were curious about the interaction between tasting familiar and unfamiliar foods when you are in a positive mood or in a stressed mood. So we thought, like, especially when you're stressed, you really don't like to taste novel foods.
Yeah.
And in order to put people in stress, we also use this paradigm. So we said, after you taste these drinks, you have to sing a song.
And did it work?
Yeah, and it did. And it really, indeed, the novel food was really disliked a lot more when you, when you were under stress. But a lot more. The thing was that went down, and the familiar food went up.
Mm.
So we first thought maybe the all food experience of everything goes down in liking, but it was more, you are maybe comforted by it was soup. It was soup also, so soup is really some comforting effect. So it really went
because obviously you have people whose heart rates and everything are higher when they have to do the sing a song thing. So then that high arousal is labeled one way for unfamiliar food and another way for familiar food, isn't it?
So actually in that experiment we did not really, so we saw that again stress test induced heart rate but for everybody we mostly looked also at subjective reports and also on SIP size or other things, but
Well, you said before, like, creating real stress in a laboratory is actually quite difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing a slide by a Dutch researcher called Frank Wilhelm on ambulatory psychophysiology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he had a stress test in his lab with a very small increase of heart rate, and the person kept on wearing the sensor, and then the heart rate was really, really high in the evening.
They were
watching
a football game. Yeah, I know that study.
and so you were kind of wondering what are they doing
yeah.
in the lab, because they're obviously not that stressed
or
they're not that activated.
Yeah. But for that particular study, I thought maybe they were also cheering or
jumping
moving.
Up and down. But I think he makes a point.
But it's true. Yeah, it is. Yeah, that is really a problem.
But I saw that you'd done a study of looking at stress before people have some kind of eye operation.
Oh, yeah.
So that's
was
a real-world stress?
Yes, yeah. So that was also an effort to get real stress.
Yeah.
And because that was also in collaboration with this eye laser clinic. And they also said, like, those people are already brave that they want to do this operation.
Yeah, sure.
But still, some people faint and so on. It happens there, and so we compared patients who were about to undergo eye laser surgery to control participants. And then you have a between subjects comparison.
Okay.
And of course, people differ in baseline heart rate and so on. Anyway.
Yeah.
But we could find...
I imagine it was quite a big difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is it mainly heart rate and skin conductance and things like that you were looking at with that one?
Yeah, what was it? Skin conductance and heart rate.
Yeah.
And also... Yeah. Maybe... But the skin conductance, if I remember correctly, did not... that is really so different between people that we did not find an effect, but heart rate we did. Yeah.
And some other stuff that you've done on mental workload. And again, this was something we were talking about earlier today in a professional context of why we're here. So you've done work, I know, where you've taken psychophysiology and you've taken EEG and you've taken other measures like eye movement and try to use them to detect when people are in a high state of mental workload or a low state of mental workload. Is that mainly being with working memory tasks?
Yeah, like that was NBEC.
NBEC task?
Yeah, so that's really working memory controls, working memory tasks.
Yeah, laboratory tasks. Yeah.
And that was also because there is so many literature on all these different variables that are supposed to be responsive to workload.
Yes.
And we really, with that study, we wanted to have a controlled experiment that's really in which you could kind of compare all these different. So that's really, that was the aim to kind of compare them in one.
Did you reach a conclusion about which was the best category of measurement for that, for the NBAC?
Very clear.
Yeah. EEG. easily, yeah.
And we looked at P300 and also more frequency measures.
Yeah.
And actually in that experiment we only used 8 EEG electrodes and going from 8 to 1 on PZ it was not a big decrease. So people should not use all these. No, maybe not necessary. No, at least for P300, I think
we've done work on that as well, and we found P3 and FZ AFZ were the most important sites.
Yeah, we did not really find the frontal thing, so that was bit, still don't know why actually, but
we found theta.
Yes.
Theta from the frontal sites and alpha from the parietal sites.
Because frontal theta is a very often reported finding, but somehow we didn't. And the other thing that after EEG, pupil size was very clear. And that's also something that we see often.
Perhaps you can, there's something, I'm not biased against pupil size, but I have an issue with it, is that I think it's kind of, it can be, under certain circumstances, quite difficult to collect the data because of light changes.
Yeah.
But really, it is just sympathetic and parasympathetic activity, which you could argue you can get from other places. But you find it more sensitive than, say, heart rate?
Yeah.
Now, heart rate's another organ that's informed by sympathetic and parasympathetic activity, just like the muscles inside the eye for the pupil are as well. So you find it to be more sensitive?
Really? Yeah. Mm. At least, so heart. Because I do, it's only reflecting this. I think that's also a strength. That it's quite clear what it reflects relatively.
Yes. Yeah.
Also with skin conductance, that is, you always see it go in the same direction, and pupil size also with arousal it goes up.
Yeah,
gets bigger, and heart rate that can go kind of everywhere. So because it's that's maybe still topic of research, but it can go down like with attention, and it goes up with other arousal, and often these things are kind of mixed or can be maybe different between people, and then you get like these data in the literature. Sometimes it goes this way, sometimes that way, and beforehand it's difficult to say sometimes which direction it goes.
Yeah.
And heart rate variability so we often in our experiments we have these short time intervals, and it's a bit difficult to extracted.
But I think that's partly to do with respiration. Myself.
Yeah, respiration.
I think respiration is an intervening variable with heart rate. Yeah. But that's another thing.
Yeah.
So reading through your stuff, because obviously I knew you as a BCI person, and then I saw this food stuff appearing. So was that something you chose to do, or was this a project that came in?
Yeah, that kind of came in, actually.
Yeah.
And that was also one of the examples that I did not really think of that before. And also, it's maybe touching a bit upon neuromarketing kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought this was a good opportunity also to look at it like without the interest, the commercial interest that neuromarketing is.
Objectively.
We really try to not only record these physiological measures, but also verbal reports and other like implicit behavioral measures, like SIP size. So and we try to kind of compare them, how sensitive are they to distinguish between.
So you're using physiology, aren't you? Because I notice you're using heart rate. But surely if you're eating, then your heart rate increases because of metabolism?
Yeah. So there, part of the work on this is with Kikkoman, a soy sauce company. And in those studies, we have also studies on watching pictures and so on. But with the real food, we have people take a sip of a drink. So it is kind of controlled. it can be even more controlled if you put fluid in somebody's mouth with a straw and so on. But we had kind of intermediate. And then that was also a thing that we saw, that this taking a sip, if you look at the physiological responses kind of locked to that moment that it takes it.
So it's
you
an effect. Yeah.
Some, yeah, that you see in all the measures a kind of very systematic, nice time dependent.
I should say, because we're on audio, that Amory's moving her hand upwards and then downwards. Yeah. So we got that. So we have this, that's a pattern. When people take a sip, you have an increase and then a decrease.
Yes.
That happens,
and that can be caused by motor activity, swallowing.
Yeah.
But then the interesting thing is that we see that it's really modulated by arousal also, because we always, or in that study, we have a ground truth, negative high arousal drink.
Yeah, oh really, okay.
To stress out people talking about.
And what's then, in the drink that's a negative high arousal drink?
Yeah, it's we used diluted vinegar. And you see the response in all the measures gets kind of bigger. So that portion is probably another with the food research is with Unilever.
Yeah.
And they are interested in more the process of cooking.
Yes.
So what are moments of high arousal or what are important moments in this kind of everyday practice of cooking?
Yes.
So that was kind of the research question there.
Okay. So when people are literally preparing food. So when is their arousal highest?
Yeah.
I guess normally when they're working with something that's hot. Is that what happens normally?
And we did also with contrasting high emotional, low emotional cooking with mealworms versus chicken. So we really think of anything to have clear ground truth emotion. No, but the other thing with which moments during cooking are important or relevant. So then what you say, you have also movements and things that affect it. So how can you do this? Our approach was that we really had people to do some controlled cooking. so we had kind of instructions now put the oil in the pan, stir, now
at the same
do
time
this. So we could kind of compare between participants, and we had this we had them also do the same movements without cooking. So you stare like something, and there's nothing. Like you smell something. You don't. And then we kind of use that as a kind of baseline. Like this is kind of the heart rate that you get when you make these movements.
Yeah.
And then we can compare that to the heart rate. So when they were doing the actual cooking.
Okay.
So. That was the approach.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah. So you're still doing that work? Is that still...
That's finished.
Okay.
Yeah, the cooking study, so we're still with Kinkelman, we're still...
Okay. So the thing I wanted to kind of close on really was the paper of yours that I really liked, which was about when you measure emotional states or mental workload states or... whatever, all these different psychological states that are of interest to both of us. You wrote a paper to advise people about how to avoid pitfalls, recommendations and pitfalls. And it was good that I think you did that paper, because I think some of those things needed to be said. So we don't need to go through all of them, but for you, if people do these experiments naively, where they're trying to say, this is... happy EEG versus sad EEG, or this is heart rate when someone is stressed or not stressed. What do you think are the main problems that people can run into if they do those sorts of studies?
People sometimes think too easily about this generalization across context. What you say, like, this is happy EEG. Like, that's really not possible. Or how... they just believe more or less what a company is saying that sells those that stuff. Because of course you can train a classifier to distinguish certain emotional states when you just say you want a classifier to distinguish EEG that goes with watching these types of pictures and that type of pictures. And then, okay, I'm done, I have this. But that does not mean that it works in another
context.
And also, I'm not sure whether that was a recommendation. And a common thing is with this movement confounds, I think, that often you see that people interpret changes in physiology or EEG that they are caused by emotions or cognition, and it's actually more noise or heart rate goes up because of movements, body movements. And that's also a difficult thing, because maybe it's often a way of formulating, because sometimes the movement can be an important source of information.
Yes,
like if you are in a context where it's always the case that you move a lot when you are under high workload, then that is informative.
And
that is also maybe thing I would like to add, that it's would be nice always to look at, okay, to think at least of other ways of gaining information. And that's also a challenge, I think, for our fields. Like, maybe you can get some information from the brain sickness, but it is only kind of useful if this is a situation where you cannot easily get it in another way. And that's not always, and that is quite challenging sometimes too. And it would be nice if people maybe think more of that, or compare it at least to other measures that are potentially also informative.
I think what you're saying really, in a way, is be a little more open-minded and creative when you're trying to work out how to measure something.
And I of course you cannot do everything always, and
it's good
also if people specialize in some signal.
And there's two things really there. I mean, the thing about if you measure someone in a certain situation in your lab, like they do the sing-a-song test, this does not mean that if they do an exam or something in real life, this is the way they're going to respond. It's this generalization problem. And that's really all about context. The context is driving all of these signals that we talk about. And the other thing is that there is, on the other side, there is enormous commercial pressure to push for systems that recognize emotions. So there's a lot of stuff going on with facial recognition software now. And I read on Twitter the other day that a AI research Ethics Research Institute had recommended that emotion recognition technology should be banned because it is so inaccurate and can lead to misleading results. And if people are making important decisions based on that, that is a problem.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't disagree with that. No. I can see by your expression. No.
No, I think it's, for ethics, it is a bit unethical to give people devices with claims that are not true, or at least people should understand what it means. So also, you know, these watches that say, I'm stressed.
Yeah.
You're stressed. People also, you can also make people believe a lot about these kind of vague things. People can say, oh, I'm stressed. I didn't realize it. And I mean, it can be harmless or it can even help people. I don't know, but it's,
It can be the opposite as well, I think. But I think it's a difficult, because the only way to combat that is to make people aware of all the stuff that you've just told me about. And not everyone wants to engage with that sort of level.
Yeah, and anyway, we can, of course, try to do our research in such a way to kind of solve these things or to be able to generalize better or...
It is our problem as well as the commercial sector's problem as well. Okay, brilliant. Thanks very much. I think we can finish that. So that was me talking to Anne-Marie Brouwer in Toulouse at the end of 2019. I'd like to thank Anne-Marie for her time, because we had quite a crowded schedule during that visit, I think. And I hope the background noise didn't spoil your enjoyment of our conversation too much. So as usual, I'll be putting some notes and some links up about this episode on the webpage. And in the meantime, thanks very much for listening.